So what I want to talk to you about are mass eigenstate couplings, an explicit example, and then flesh out this point I was just mentioning about custodial symmetry, this mysterious, it's not going to be so mysterious in a moment, symmetry that has to do with this triplet of masses that were the same in a certain limit of the standard model. That's quite important because it leads to strong constraints on physics beyond the standard model, as was how we kind of learned about things like the Higgs mechanism indirectly before we explicitly found it in 2012, that particle. We had indirect quantum mechanical evidence for it, and I'll talk to you about that. So I think I'll get through all of that, and then I want to really then use that to basically motivate talking about constraints on physics beyond the standard model due to two-point functions, other things that can further violate custodial symmetry, which is where you get these strong constraints. And hopefully, I think I'll have enough time to get into like motivation of how this sort of thing leads to a general idea of how we kind of test the standard model precisely in terms of the properties of the Z and the properties of the Higgs. Okay, so I think we'll get through that. And ideally, we'll also then start to talk a little bit about Higgs production and decay, because we actually found this thing. And so I'll just like kind of sketch out in an introductory fashion how we actually found this thing at LHC. Hopefully. But that might take us into Thursday a little bit. Okay, so that's the plan. So just to be complete here in the discussion, now that we've expanded around the VEV and we have these mass eigenstate gauge bosons, we then take our covariant derivative and we can express it in terms of the mass eigenstate gauge bosons. Okay, so we have to do the fields, we have to redefine the fields as we discussed yesterday in the covariant derivative. And then the covariant derivative can either be acting on the fermion field or on the Higgs, right? So sometimes you'll have color fields around, and you'll have this when you have the fermion pairs. Other times when it's acting on the Higgs, it's not colored, so this is not around, no gluon couplings. But now we've re-expressed, we introduced, remember, this W plus and this W minus, and we've re-expressed it in terms of the mass eigenstate fields. This is the coupling, and we introduced this T plus and T minus. These are called raising and lowering operators. They're combinations of the Pauli matrices. Comes with the coupling. The Z now is coupling, and we start to, now be careful here with notation. This is T3, which is actually an operator, which is related to something called isospin, and this actually returns values, okay? So it returns like a half or minus a half, depending on the field it acts. And I'll, when we talk about the Z's in more detail, I'll give that to you more precisely. This is also an operator with the charge. So we're just rotating to the mass eigenstate coupling of the Z. This is the effective coupling we get. And also for the photon, this is the effective coupling. This is what's usually called the electric charge, G2 sine theta. Okay, and then this is an operator again, giving back the number. This thing is usually sometimes called GZ. Okay, so just to be clear, that's how it goes, now that we're in mass eigenstate fields. So I think it's useful to just remind you of one particular thing about the W, because it's going to come in terms of a calculation I'm going to sketch out for you in terms of custodial symmetry. So if you have the fermion, for example, the covariant derivative here, then there's a piece where you have this raising and lowering operators appear for the W plus and the W minus, okay? This thing appears here, and it's sandwiched between these Q left bar and Q fields, so it's an up bar, down bar, up, down. Right, with the gamma. So this guy, the way this works, the raising and lowering operator, if you just work it out, the definition is this was T1 and T2 in terms of the Pauli matrices with a half, right? So there's a plus minus here. So you just add these things up and you just see that this is just this 2 by 2, okay? And also with the T minus, it's just this 2 by 2. So when you plug this guy in, and I think you're gonna see this shows up in a moment. You plug this guy in, it just picks out the down, up, bar, down component, right? So that's what you get, an up, bar, down component, which also conserves electric charge for W+. But remember, there's a further step we need to do. These, at this point, are weak eigenstate fermion fields. We've gone to mass eigenstates for the gauge bosons, but we haven't rotated the fermions yet. When we rotate the fermions to mass eigenstates, we talked about that a bunch the first day. Remember, we introduced these U's for each rotation for the lefts and the rights. Well, then you just get a further thing, which is the CKM matrix, because this is this overlap matrix of the ups and the downs, right? So the combination of those two rotations was this 3 by 3 complex matrix, okay? So similarly with the W minus, you just get a down bar up and the story goes through, and you have the other lowering operator. So it picks out this other guy. And you get a CKM dagger. Now the CKM matrix actually has a phase. It has one phase. Remember there were four parameters? It was an M by N matrix, but then we use rephasing of the quark fields to reduce the number of parameters. So it ended up with four parameters. And one of them is the complex phase that's present in the standard model, which leads to CP violation. So this being a dagger versus it not being daggered here, it matters because the phase then flips sign when you take a dagger. So when you start to do calculations, you have to start to be careful about that. Okay? So that's just fleshing out how it all fits together in terms of the mass eigenstate fields, completing the discussion that we were in yesterday. Okay, so hopefully that's clear. Is that clear? Just for completeness, let me just remind you that this, as I just said, is equal to this up left rotation, and then it was this rotation from weak to mass eigenstates for the down left. Remember, that was the definition of VCKM. Okay? All right, so it's getting a bit more complicated, but that's just the way it is in terms of the standard model. It gets the Feynman rules get a bit advanced and get developed this way. Okay, so now that's all clear, which it should be, and we're going to come back to that in a moment. We're going to use that for a calculation we need to do to think about precision tests of the standard model. Let's think about custodial symmetry. Okay, so what's this? Now remember, I said this thing yesterday in motivation. Remember the masses that we got out when we expanded d mu h dagger d mu h with two vevs? So we basically took this. Now we got these two mass terms. Okay, remember these mass terms. There was one, which was g2 squared v squared over 8. I'm going to write in terms of w1 mu plus w2. I'm not going to do w plus minus here just because it's suggestive in terms of the triplet that we're going to talk about. So that was this guy. And then we add another term, which is g1 squared plus g2 squared v squared over 8. And that was the thing that was essentially the z. G2 squared W3 mu minus G1 B mu square root of G1 squared plus G2 squared all squared. So we had these two terms that we wrote out just expanding directly. Now, the thing that you can do is you can stare at this and you can say, wait a minute, we're going to take G1 goes to zero. So that's going to simplify this. Well, we can just even cancel this guy off. And then we're going to get rid of this term. And we take g1 goes to 0. And then what do we have left? We have left something which has exactly got the same expression for the mass. So there is a W triplet around, which has the same mass. Okay, so we can basically group it up like this. And it's a triplet of something, some symmetry group, which has to do with after you take the VEV for the standard model Higgs, and then you take G1 goes to zero. So first of all, because we had to take G1 goes to zero, this is what's known as a partial symmetry. So only some terms in L's standard model preserve it. We have a ton of partial symmetries in the standard model. We also have accidental symmetries. We have explicitly gauged symmetries. And it's very useful to identify these because they can give you some conceptual understanding and also technical understanding of how the calculation should work in terms of the details, especially when you start to do loop corrections. So we have to do G1 goes to zero, and it's something to do with the VEV. So what is this symmetry? We're going to dig it out of the standard model. It wasn't in SU3 across SU2 across U1. It's going to be a symmetry that's in some terms that exists in a limit of the standard model. Okay? Okay, so there's another thing where I'm going to show you, which is why I was writing down the coupling for the W's as well. which is it's not just that you need this, you also need yd goes to 0, y up goes to 0, yl goes to 0. So we also need the Yukawas to go to 0, or more precisely, the mass splittings that are in the doublet fields to go to 0. Yep.
So the coupling for W3 will be G24 there, no?
Coupling for W3 will be G24?
Yeah, because...
Well, but this just cancels this, and there's a G2 squared W3.
Oh, yeah, sorry, excuse me. Yeah.
Sorry, I mean, you don't need to have to take the G1 here. I mean, you can do it if you want, but it just all cancels out.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
This is the same. Okay, so we also are going to need to take the Yukawas, or the more precisely, the mass differences in the doublets to be zero for this symmetry to be preserved. So let me show you what I mean by this. Okay, so we want to dig this symmetry out. We know it has something to do with the VEV being taken, so it's something to do with the Higgs sector of the Lagrangian, and G1 goes to zero. So it's a rather straightforward hypothesis to think that we should stare very hard at this guy and think about maybe there's a partial symmetry in here, which we haven't appreciated fully as yet. Of course, there's also this term, where we have to take this and we have to take G1 goes to zero, but let's just stare at this potential here. Okay, so this is H dagger H. Okay, so if it's H dagger H, this is really only constraining and giving a VEV to one particular combination of those four components of the Higgs field, which we could write in terms of real scalars, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4. So if we write H, I know there's all sorts of different notations, and I apologize for that, but the different notations are actually useful for bringing out different aspects of the physics, which is why they're historically present in the literature. They're actually there for a reason. Because remember, yesterday we were talking about like H plus up here, which was this combination, and then the real and imaginary. It's just the way it is that, you know, I'm just trying to stick to historical convention to a degree so you can look at the literature. But anyways, the point is H dagger H is equal to, this is square root of 2, phi 1 squared, phi 2 squared, plus phi 3 squared, plus phi 4 squared. All right? So what's really being constrained here is this combination. This is sometimes called the radial component of the Higgs field. Now, we call it the radial component because there's an implicit kind of Cartesian idea here going on in terms of the way we're writing this down in four real scalar fields. We could also write this, that's just a coordinate choice though for the scalars. We could also write this in terms of a radial component and then angular decomposition. So that's why it's called the radial component. Anyways, that's the only thing being constrained here. So only this gets a vacuum expectation value. So if that's the case, it's actually in here that you actually have an SO4 symmetry, because you can take phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, and phi 4, and you can rotate those just with a rotation matrix to a phi 1 prime, phi 2 prime, phi 3 prime, phi 4 prime, and H dagger H will be invariant under that rotation. So there's an SO4 symmetry. So is that the symmetry? Well, not quite, but we're getting there. So there's a symmetry in just this term of the Lagrangian of that form for the Higgs field. Of course, it can be broken by other terms, but at least that part of the Lagrangian preserves that symmetry. So what we do is we want to dig out a little bit more information about this symmetry. So it's a group theory fact that this is isomorphic. To an SU2 cross SU2. And this is, we're going to have a left-right SU2. And these are going to be left and right transformations on something to do with the scalar field. Okay? So We want to make that symmetry manifest in the theory. We want to have a representation of the scalar field, which makes the symmetry as simple as possible to think about. And that's not the Higgs field in the way that we're writing in terms of these coordinates. We would like to have a linear transformation of just the Pauli matrices acting on the left and the Pauli matrices acting on the right of some way, something we can construct from H, which makes the symmetry manifest. Now remember, it's combinations of H which have this constraint, which has the symmetry, so we probably should do combinations of H in terms of a field that we define. We're allowed to redefine our fields in terms of functions of other fields. This is a general thing we can do in field theory. So it might not be obvious, and it probably isn't obvious, but at the end of the day, people figured out, it might be obvious to some, that there's a bi-doublet Higgs field that you can define. And what it is in its definition, it's going to be a combination of the Higgs field, because it's just, this symmetry has to do with just the Higgs and this potential. And we're going to define this thing, and it's going to be defined in this exact way. The Pauli matrix again comes in. And then we have H star. And then we have H. So if I make these indices explicit, this has an index I, this has an ij, because it's 2 by 2, and this, you know, has another index k, so it's 1 to 2. So this is something which is actually a 2 by 2 matrix built out of the Higgs field. Okay, it's called the Higgs bi-doublet field. It's not very fancy. When you take this guy and you write down the potential, what you get is, when you write it down in terms of that bi-doublet field, you get a trace that form. But this thing is nice because if you actually act on it with an SU2 and an SU2 left and an SU2 right with Pauli matrices, it actually has that linear representation of that symmetry. Okay, so it's making the symmetry manifest. Okay, but that's, so we're on our way to figuring out what this custodial group is. Remember, it had to do with taking the VEV of the Higgs field, right? It was only after we took the Higgs to a VEV that we had any masses at all, and we're having a triplet in terms of masses. So what is the VEV of the bi-doublet field? Well, remember, we use SU2 rotations to make this 0 V over square root of 2. And if we just plug it in here, you can derive directly that it's V, is it square root of 2 or 2? Yeah, it's square root of 2 again. 0, 0, V over square root of 2. Okay. So it's diagonal. So when we take the VEV, this one has a diagonal VEV, which then acts on these two groups. So when you take the VEV, this breaks down to a diagonal subgroup, which is another SU2, where the left and right-handed transformations are identified. Okay, so in general, this could be different symmetries with different transformations at this stage. But then you have to have the same parameter associated and the same Pauli matrices on the left and the right. That diagonal subgroup is called the vectorial subgroup, which is when SU2 left is equal to SU2 right. So there's three unbroken generators when you have that identification on the left and the right, when you take the VEV. That is what is the custodial symmetry group that this mass is a triplet under, that the combination of masses, the W1s, W2s, W3s, is a triplet under. Okay, so this is a custodial symmetry. So this is perhaps a bit mysterious, but this is essentially a symmetry that's in part of the Lagrangian that you have to kind of dig around and play with group theory to kind of see its manifest representation. Okay? This is, you might, okay, so, and just to be clear, phi had this transformation on the left and the right. So this guy under this transforms as this left SU2 and this right SU2. I mean, I said it in words, but that's exactly what it is. Okay, that's the vectorial subgroup, which is the custodial symmetry group. So you might say to yourself, well, that's a terrible symmetry. right? Because it's not even preserved in the full part of the Lagrangian, right? It's, we had to take g1 goes to zero, we had to take the Yukawa is going to zero, or the doublet mass splitting more precisely to zero. So you might say, why bother thinking about such a thing? Wrong way to think. Because if you can identify a symmetry in part of the Lagrangian, and you know it's breaking in terms of the explicit way the Lagrangian is written down in terms of the standard model, you can really build some very good intuition as to how the breaking at tree level works. But not only that, you can also start to have a good conceptual sense of how it should work at loop level. So anything you can have in terms of guidance of how the loop correction should go before you explicitly do them when they're very complicated is a very good conceptual thing to have in your hands. So let's look at how in the standard model you actually break custodial symmetry. Well, one thing is that it's explicitly broken at tree level as soon as G1 is there, okay? And then this triplet breaks into, you know, the mass of the W, and then part of the mass of the Z. Okay? So even at just tree level, we know the masses split it. So it should be the case that experimental information on the masses and theoretical calculations involving masses should be guidance in terms of how this breaking works in terms of the standard model. And we're really good at measuring masses experimentally and calculating them theoretically because they're two-point functions. Okay, so how do I do this? This is, oh no. Ah, okay. Okay, so let's see how these masses work, okay? So we want to see how the masses are affected by G1 and by doublet splittings. Where like the mass of the up quark is not equal to the mass of the down quark, the mass of the top quark is not equal to the mass of the bottom quark, because these were in the SU2 doublets. Okay? So the way to do this, we can do quantum corrections just directly. Okay? And the quantum corrections, as well as at tree level, we start to shift the mass of the Z and the W. So remember at tree level, or remember experimentally, we know that MW is like 80, and MZ is like 92 GV. So we know this splitting is a bit substantial in terms of the masses in the spectrum. We compare the Z and the W mass. But how if we actually calculate quantum corrections involving G1 and mass differences of ups and downs, do we get further contributions to the mass? That's kind of the key question to kind of follow the symmetry breaking. So I wrote down for you over here, let me pull it so you can stare at it while I do this. I wrote this down on this purpose. Okay, so we just saw, you know, how you have W couplings at the end of the day. Oh, it's not this one. And it's not this one. It's this one. W couplings at the end of the day to mass eigenstate ups and downs that can be top and bottom or up and down. Right? So let's just do those, let's just look at those diagrams. Okay? For the masses. So we can have a W. We can have a W. And in here, there could be a top and a bottom. Right? Because that's what's in those couplings. You have a VCKM tube, and you just have to do all the Feynman rules. But in these diagrams for the two-point functions, for WW, there's definitely a contribution from the top and the bottom in the loop, okay? So if there's a contribution from the top and the bottom in the loop, then we expect a contribution once we do the two-point function and project onto just the mass term, which will equal, it's going to be a function of the top mass, the bottom mass squared, it's going to be 16 pi squared, and the makeup of the dimensions, it'll have to be v squared down below. Okay? Now, we can also do these sorts of calculations for the z. So for the z, we also have fermion loops like this. But in that case, it's just the top and the top diagonally, or the bottom and the bottom. Okay? So if we look at this will give a contribution to the mass, but it will not be the same function, right? Because we're not going to have in the same loop diagram tops and bottoms. So there's going to be a further mass difference, a further splitting in terms of this degenerate triplet and the G1 goes to zero limit. There's going to be a further splitting in the mass spectrum due to these quantum corrections when you have turned on the Yukawas and have doublets around. That's true for all the fermions, but the biggest effect is the top-bottom splitting compared to top-top, bottom-bottom. Okay, so we can calculate this, and the exact answer is the following. So remember there was this rho parameter. Okay? And its definition was mw squared over cosine squared mz squared. It's 1. So if you look at the mass expression for the z and the mass expression for the w and put the cosine in here, you correct, so it gets to the same thing. And that's equal to 1. Okay? And now we have a further contribution to the mass for the w and the mass to the z. So you get a correction factor to the rho parameter. Once you put in a mass shift here and a mass shift here, and you expand out, you can get a further correction to the rho parameter due to doublet splitting. And it's equal to this. So there's 3 because we have the quarks running in the loop. There's 3 different colors, right? So even when we have the off-diagonal top-bottom, it's still 3 different colors. We had it wasn't like a gluon coupling. The color index was contracted between the 2 quark fields. So when we actually run around the loop, that happens for 3 different colors. So we should have an NC, and that's this. We get a 16 pi squared, which should not surprise you for the loops, V squared because we're setting the scales, and then we actually get this expression. And then it's minus 2 mt squared mb squared mt squared minus mb squared. And then there's a log of mt squared over mb squared. Okay, this is a calculable effect in the theory, which has to do with further differences between the masses, which is associated with further breaking of custodial symmetry. Okay. It might not look obvious to you, but as mt goes to mb, this actually goes to 0. So it's the doublet splitting that's leading to these effects. It's a subtle limit. You can take it, and you'll see that that's the case. With mt is very different from mb, 173 versus 4 GeV. Okay. So that actually is quite a splitting that happens. But it's calculable, and we know it. Okay. So we can do another thing. Remember, we also had the breaking, even at tree level, due to hypercharge interactions. Okay, so if we look at hypercharge interactions and we look at d mu h, we get a tree level contribution. To mz, right? And if we actually do the loop corrections that come out of the Feynman rules for this that are associated with G1, there's another 2 diagrams that we can calculate. We can calculate this, and also this diagram. And we can calculate it for W's, and we can calculate it for Z's. Okay? And then we put the contributions in for the shift of the 2-point function for the W and the shift of the 2-point function for the Z. It's calculable. And you get another contribution to the row parameter due to G1 effects at one loop. And the answer for this is actually equal to minus 11 after you do the whole calculation. It's a non-trivial calculation, but the point is it's calculable. It's mz squared over v squared sine squared theta, and then another log. And this log is very interesting. Okay? So why does this go as just mz? Well, conceptually it goes as that because at tree level, when you put g1 in even at tree level, you shifted what you call the z mass compared to the w mass. So when you do the quantum corrections, you can shuffle things around so that you're getting the shift just proportional to the z mass. It may not be obvious, but that's the case. You have to do these diagrams out, some work, but at the end of the day, you get this. But look at this, because this was the Higgs field, okay? So even if we're doing experiments at masses far below the Higgs mass, even before we found it, which is what happened historically in the 90s, we have a logarithmic sensitivity to the Higgs mass if we're calculating in the standard model. And it shifts this rho parameter, which we can experimentally construct by taking masses and other masses and taking ratios. We can very precisely measure masses in colliders. So we have indirect evidence for the Higgs even before we find it directly in the collider. We can actually constrain its mass. So this leads to, so what you do is you measure, it's actually a bit more involved than this, but basically you measure, and we'll get into how more involved it is, it's basically measure mz and mw, and that includes the quantum corrections. So when we have like the mass of 92 or 80, you know, when we measure this thing in reality, it's not just the tree level result. It's also including the quantum corrections. That's actually what we measure. So by taking this and then looking at what we basically can construct in terms of the ratios of the masses, we are sensitive to these theoretical one loop calculations that we can do. So we are sensitive by the measured value of the Z mass and the W mass in a consistency test of the standard model to what the Higgs mass should be for the experimental result that we get for the rho parameter, which we construct from those measurements and combining them up. This is an example of basically doing combinations of measurements and looking for consistency tests of the standard model. Okay, this is just one example involving two-point functions, but this actually gives us sensitivity for MH. So from the measurements of the Z mass and the W mass, this was in the 90s at something called LEP, which is the Large Electron Positron Collider. So that was in CERN, the CERN tunnel before LHC. So in the 90s, we measured properties of Z. And then we actually, in the 2000s, had something called the Tevatron, which was in Chicago, or outside Chicago. That is where we measured the mass of the W, very precisely. And we can use those to construct up. And before 2012, when we discovered the Higgs, we can get the idea that MH is probably going to be in the hundreds of GeV. That's exactly what we had. We had logarithmic sensitivity for the Higgs mass, and we had indirect experimental evidence that we should find it at a couple hundred GeV. So what you actually do, the actual numbers are this. Oh, I guess I'll go over here. So the actual numbers are the following.
There are two things.
Don't think we're going to get to Higgs production and decay, but hopefully we'll finish the electric precision discussion. Okay. So what you actually do is you recognize that the rho parameter was one at tree level, and then these calculable contributions, the delta rho due to doublet splitting, plus the delta rho at one loop due to hypercharge. And this is what you actually measure, what you actually find in terms of the masses. So when you actually take the masses and you construct experimentally the rho parameter, what we actually do is we actually take the rho we experimentally find from the masses, and we divide out these quantum corrections. So this with this correction. We'll call this tilde. So then we have rho experimental, and if we expand these out, which is perturbation theory, we should subtract off again these guys. And you're going to subtract off the quantum corrections. And then again, you expect that this is equal to 1, right? Because we've had it 1 at tree level. We include the quantum corrections are there in the measured masses. We include the quantum corrections in the theoretical calculation. We normalize out the quantum corrections. And then we basically check to see if this thing that we construct experimentally is 1 when we normalize out the quantum corrections. So what do they find? So an experiment, after an enormous amount of work by hundreds of people in a giant machine running data for like many, many years, spending many millions of dollars, we find that rho, corrected in this way, with the quantum corrections removed, is 1.00039 plus or minus 0.00019. Okay? So within 2 sigma, once you subtract out the quantum corrections, so once you calculate things at one loop and remove them, this is the residual. So at 2 sigma, this is consistent with the standard model. So 2 sigma just happens in terms of statistics. This is not evidence of physics beyond the standard model. This consistency test works so long as MH is about 125 GV, which we now know. Okay, so as a consistency test, this fits together. Okay, and it was following from custodial symmetry being identified, custodial symmetry us understanding it's breaking at tree level, and then us calculating it's breaking at one loop level, and then following that through as a symmetry test. So when you test the symmetry breaking pattern of the standard model Lagrangian, whether it's custodial symmetry or flavor symmetry, which we're going to talk about in a couple days, you get very precise tests of the standard model dynamics. And you get very strong constraints on physics beyond the standard model. Because when you start to put in stuff with the standard model in the extra stuff, which has other groups and other dynamics, it doesn't have to align in its symmetry breaking pattern with the standard model symmetry breaking pattern, unless you build that in by hand. So you get very strong constraints on physics beyond the standard model in these precision consistency tests like this. This is just a leading example. Okay? So is that clear? Okay, so it should be obvious that following two-point functions and calculating two-point functions is an important constraint on the consistency of the standard model, but also on possible physics beyond the standard model. So you'll not be surprised that some very famous physicists, some of their famous work from the 90s, was essentially just doing that. It's like, well, let's just formalize how physics beyond the standard model can affect two-point functions. So if I have L standard model plus L beyond the standard model, how does it affect pi ww, the two-point function for the w, the two-point function for the z? Okay? That was kind of a key theoretical development which let us interface with the data and understand these constraints. It's all following from custodial symmetry. So what was done was, well, that was the obvious thing to do. So a whole bunch of groups did it. Some got quite famous for it. No one got a Nobel Prize, but it was quite influential in the field. So let's define how two-point functions. Are shifted in general from whatever you put in the loops of the W and Z. Okay? So long as it's in the loop, how can we characterize how these two-point functions are shifted? And how do they feed into experimental results? Turns out there's two things that you want to define. So there's two key parameters. Two key combinations. So there's something called the T parameter. And we define it like this. At MZ alpha electroweak, T, it's equal to, not a big surprise, the two-point function, evaluated at 0, divided by MW squared, minus the two-point function 0, divided by MZ squared. Okay. And there's another parameter, which is called S, which is alpha of electroweak at MZ, 4 sine squared theta cos squared theta S, and it's equal to a more complicated combination of these two-point functions. Minus, oh, this is Z gamma, which you can also get, gamma, mz squared. So the motivation of examining two-point functions should be clear from what we just discussed. But if you look closely, this is a bit like, why this combination, why this weird combination of two-point functions is the obvious question to ask. And it doesn't just have the Zs and the Ws. It also has a Z gamma, which you can have. Loop corrections can make a Z with a loop go into a gamma. And also it's gamma. So it should not be obvious to you why this particular combination of two-point functions defines a parameter which is useful experimentally. That's a non-trivial analysis, which is why those guys, you know, got some significant credit in the field for figuring it out. Of figuring out how a whole bunch of different observables are shifted by common combinations of two-point functions, and it turns out these two are common combinations of two-point functions that show up in a series of observables I'll define for you. Okay, so it wasn't obvious when they did it at the time, but it is obvious if you think about it in a different way, which is what I've been emphasizing to you all through the discussion we've been having, which is thinking in terms of an effective theory. Okay, so another way of thinking about this is just thinking about it in terms of phenomenological two-point functions. You know, some things in these loops, and this particular combination you can figure out shifts a bunch of observables in a nice way. A cleaner way to think about it, the modern way to think about it, is in terms of operators. Okay. Let me just leave that here so you can compare. When you think about it in terms of operators, it's nicer. Isn't that kind of consistent with this whole effective field theory discussion I've been mentioning to you. So remember the standard model, the way we defined it, the way we wrote it down from day one, was just up to dimension 4. And on a number of occasions, I've talked to you about how you can do expansions, and then you can have operators of higher mass dimension, dimension 6, dimension 8, built out of the fields and interactions. Okay? So you can also write down this. The S parameter can be defined in terms of a coefficient of an operator to be 16 pi squared v squared g1 g2 times a number, which is the number that multiplies a particular operator form. And similarly, the T parameter can be defined to be minus 2 pi v squared 1 over g1 squared plus 1 over g2 squared, chd, where chd and chwb are multiplying operators. So there's going to find an operator of this form at dimension 6, which you can just write down. Okay, so this has dimension 4, this is dimension 2, this is dimension 6. And you can often have this operator defined. Okay. So the way this works is if you take the standard model Lagrangian, and you add CHWB times QHWB with some scale, which we don't know, which we associate with some mass for physics beyond the standard model, probably, plus CHD QHD with some scale. There's other operators of this form. Then you look at how these two operators contribute to the two-point functions. They do exactly this combination of shifts for these two-point functions we defined with kind of brute force explicitly. So this should give you an idea as to why this particular combination was something that appeared in a whole series of observables. It's because it's actually, when you think about it in terms of operators and effective field theory thinking, it's actually just the coefficient, it's one universal number, times this particular operator and this particular operator. So that's why it appears as this universal shift in a bunch of different observables. Okay? This is the modern way of thinking about it. So the S and T parameter are highly constrained, whether you think of in terms of the coefficient of an operator or this combination of two-point functions. What are the constraints? So experimentally, what are the experimental constraints? S is equal to the best of our knowledge, 0.10. T is equal to 0.05 plus or minus 0.12. And there's a correlation of 0.89 with these constraints. So what this means, if you look in the literature, you'll see a plot of T and S, and it's like this very small ellipse around 0, 0. When we define it in such a way as to remove the standard model contributions, and this angle is the 0.89 correlation. Very strong constraints. And if you take these constraints, they're constraints on this number, which we don't know, which can come about in lots of different ways for physics beyond the standard model, divided by this scale. And when you take the vacuum expectation value, to get the contribution to two-point functions, you get a v squared in the numerator out of each of these because they have Higgs fields. So this becomes v squared in some way with some combinations of field strengths. So that's what's the mass terms for shifting things around. Two of these guys become BEVs, and you get out of the derivatives here the field strengths you need for building up the two-point functions. Okay? So this will be v squared over lambda squared. V squared, the electric scale divided by some heavy mass scale and an unknown coefficient. But those numerical constraints constrain those combinations. Okay? All right. This is an example, and this is the way I wanted to introduce to you something called electric precision constraints on the standard model. This is just one example of them. Mass shifts, two-point function shifts, and S and T kind of minimal constraints from a series of observables. So what observables are leading to these experimental constraints? It's not just the masses. It's a set of different, it's a whole set of things that we measured for about 20 years before we found the Higgs. So I want to just define those to you before we finish up today. So let me actually go over here and define them. So a lot of these things, these precision observables, have to do with the properties of the Z. And the reason for that is because we built a machine dedicated to doing exactly that, this electron-positron collider in the early 90s. All it did was basically took E plus E minus and scanned through the Z peak. and it looked at the properties of the Z in terms of the decays of its final state. Okay, so remember we had the definition of the mass eigenstate coupling for the Z, which is the first thing I wrote down. So electroweak precision we have this, we have psi and psi, and the coupling from psi bar I d slash psi for the fermion fields was equal to minus psi bar in this convention, this T3, which had to do with the state, sine theta q, which had to do with the state, these are operators, z mu gamma mu psi. And then we had square root of g1 squared plus g2 squared. So this T3 acting on fermion fields is actually equal to a half, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1. It's just derivable from the initial covariant derivative we wrote down for psi equals ups, neutrinos, downs, and electrons. So we have z decaying into all of these guys. And the electric charge, of course, is just straightforward. So from this, we can calculate the z decay width. The z decays into all the fermions except for the top because the top's too heavy. And we can just calculate it directly. We have an amplitude we get from this Feynman rule. We take the amplitude squared. It's 1 to 2 body decays. We integrate over phase space. It's a very straightforward calculation. We can define a decay width. So the decay width is denoted where this is the decay to a particular final state pair psi. So what the whole set of observables is that we actually use to basically get these constraints is the Z mass, the W mass, and a series of other observables, which are a bit esoteric, but let me define them for you so you know what's actually going on. So what can you measure? So this is a machine. So what we measured in terms of the machine was the following. Okay, so we went square root of S, and there's a peak around MZ. And what we actually did was we actually ran the machine for like each year at a different value of square root of S around what we were expecting to be the Z mass. So it was run all the way through, scanning through the Z peak with different experimental runs. And then we fit that data with a function. So what we did was we basically had, we fit the cross section as a function of S for particular final states because the machine was running E plus E minus through a Z, but then it could be coming a whole bunch of different final states, which we identified experimentally. And we fit this function, there's a psi bar psi, which is exactly something psi bar psi, which is a peak normalization. And then we did S gamma S squared, or gamma Z squared, and S minus MZ squared, plus S squared gamma Z squared over MZ squared. This is a function of S because it's a Britt-Wigner resonance shape. So we just fit it. And we extract this. Simultaneously, we extract the Z mass and the Z total decay width. So we just fit this thing to the data. And so out of that comes MZ measured and sigma for different fermions, for different identified final states, okay? So, I'm running out of time. I want to finish on time. I've been going over too much. Let me just define these guys, and I'll stop. So what you can do is you can just actually calculate a bunch of these partial widths, but it's actually better to calculate ratios of partial widths, partially for experimental reasons, to cancel off experimental uncertainties, systematic uncertainties, and partially just to cancel off common corrections, quantum corrections to the decays to those final states. So we actually take these ratios, So the ratios are the ratios for the C and the B, which are ratios of partial widths. So we do the decay to C pairs and B pairs, which we identify from the final states and the way the quarks are identified in the detector. And then we look at the hadronic decay of the Z, and that's where we sum over all quarks. So ups, downs, bottom, churn, the light quarks as well. So we basically build this ratio, and they report this experimentally, and then we calculate it theoretically. There's another ratio, you should get upset in a moment, which is we define it this way for the leptons, for each of the individual leptons. Okay? Which is just, we also take the hadronic width of the Z, and we divide it by the partial widths into particular final state leptons. Now, why would we be so stupid as to define this with sigma hadron downstairs and this with sigma hadron upstairs? I honestly don't know. I mean, I know the people that did this work. If I was around, I would have stopped it. But it's just like this weird convention that they did in terms of the way they define the data. So be aware of this. This leads to a lot of very embarrassing mistakes in the literature if you don't realize this is the inverse in one case with what you're calculating. And then there's another thing that they actually report, which is the hadronic cross-section fitted here, which is 12 pi mz squared. And then this is built out of partial widths. And there's one last thing they do, and then I'm going to be finished, which is they also do forward-backward asymmetries for some final states. And that's equal to 3/4 forward backward asymmetry associated with the leptons and the final state fermions, where each of these asymmetries is you take the effective coupling for the Z to the lefts, and you take the effective couplings Z for the right. For the individual fermion states. Oh, I know, I'm over, sorry. And then you take this G effective, Z to the left squared plus G effective, Z to the right squared. Okay, so this is just a forward-backward asymmetry you build out of the couplings of, to the left and the right-handed fermion fields. And you take that both for the leptons and the final state fermions, you combine them up, and you get a forward-backward asymmetry they report experimentally. So this is what you actually build up in terms of your precision experimental results. They report this, they report this, they build these ratios, and they extract directly the Z mass, the total width, and this is the hadronic cross-section they extract. Those things combined with the Z mass and the W mass in a global chi-squared fit are what lead to these constraints. There's a couple other things that get into, but they're really small in terms of the effect on the experimental results, lower energy measurements. So I'm over in time, so let me stop there. Are there any questions, though, in terms of how this is defined? Yep.
So what do we mean exactly when we say that there are like corrections to two masses, for example? Because like, do we mean that we compute how they run or something? Or?
Well, there's a lot of different things. What we always, when we're talking about masses, we're talking masses at a fixed scale. A mass is a particular coefficient of a two-point function, right? And we can calculate these quantum corrections and project onto that particular coefficient. Okay, so when you have a mass, you're just experimentally extracting the thing sitting in front of the two-point function that gets into the propagators that causes these resonances. So quantum corrections that behave like the hard scale are still part of the mass in terms of what we extract. All that stuff's grouped up in terms of field and how it appears, right? Masses have loop contributions, just like diagrams have loop contributions. You look skeptical. Is this strange to you?
No. Yeah, I think I know what you mean, but I'm confused because like I know I can measure the physical mass, right? Mm-hmm. Looking at a pole or something, but when I have a mass in quantum field theory, it's just some parameter in the Lagrangian. I have some bare mass. starts getting.
Yeah, but there's a relationship between what you calculate theoretically and what you measure experimentally, which is these are the things we literally measure experimentally. And then the mass that's in the two-point function of the z is going into shifting this resonance peak around. So when we fit this thing experimentally, extract what we call the z mass, it's the bare mass plus a bunch of the quantum corrections. That's actually what we see experimentally. There's no way that, so what we measure experimentally does not distinguish between what we write down at tree level to Lagrangian and these loop corrections that we calculate order by order. The only thing we measure is the projection onto the experimental features of the tree level stuff plus these loop corrections. And that can happen both with just the perturbative corrections, as I showed you for mass shifts for the W and Z, but it can also happen if you have other physics, which when you take the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs, gives a direct contribution to two-point functions for the W and Z, and also the Z photon guy. Yeah. So we need to get out, because I think there's the next class, but is that clear?
But I still need to get some experimental input for the QFT, I guess, because the QFT itself, I mean, it
can be the mass, right? I think you're anticipating what we're going to talk about Thursday. So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to, like, these are things we measure experimentally. And what I'm going to do next, I'm going to make very precise exactly what we do when we measure a series of things and then predict things like this. Because whenever we make any theoretical prediction of these, we need to know, well, what was G1 and G2, right? How do we know that, right? So it's always a series of experimental tests of things defining what we call input parameters, which we'll discuss Thursday, which fix these values of G1 and G2 and the VEV and lambda, and that builds up at tree level what you have in terms of masses and couplings, but it also builds up the, you know, what you have for the quantum corrections when you consistently fit the data, including quantum corrections, right? So whenever you extract something like and fix a Lagrangian parameter to numerical value, we calculate theoretically, including quantum corrections, but then we measure something which is just a number experimentally. But that number has all the tree stuff, which we want to fit from the data, plus the quantum corrections built in. So it's the consistent pattern of fitting the data, mapping order by order and perturbation theory to the G's and the, you know, the other things in the theory, and then using those to predict another set of observables. That's what actually we test in terms of experimental interface. And that, once you grasp that, it should make it clear to you why it's so important to test symmetry breaking patterns. Because it's always observables related to other observables. That's all we're doing, right? And so the way observables are related to, what relates some observable to another observable in a predictive way? Symmetries. Symmetries that relate things at tree level and at loop level. So when we test symmetry breaking patterns, that's why we get a lot of sensitivity. Because that's the whole program that we're doing.